The B2B sales world is in turmoil. Quota attainment is down. Revenue growth has slowed. Turnover is up. All of this is in the face of ever-increasing pressure to perform. Is it a surprise that the average sales leader stays in place for only 12 to 18 months? That's barely enough time to start executing the strategy. These problems are fixable, and we are going to serve the sales leadership community with this show. I'm Lucas Price. I've launched and exited B2B startups and built elite sales organizations. Now I want to give back by bringing you this podcast, Building Elite Sales Teams. It will be full of actionable best practices to help you excel as a sales leader. We're going to burn the churn. Let's get back to winning. Building Elite Sales Teams is on. I'm Lucas Price, and I'm here to learn with you about building elite sales teams. How do you use your data infrastructure to enhance the success of your sales organization? There have been times for me when I'm looking at all the reports and dashboards, and it sometimes seems more overwhelming and inconclusive than helpful. I've had moments where the data said one thing that seemed very different from the things I had seen and experienced at an organization. How should a sales leader think about that? We have a great revenue leader with us here today to discuss this and more. Michelle Benfer is a longtime revenue leader who's worked at some of the world's best SaaS and media companies. She builds sales engines that are vibrant, fun, repeatable, scalable, and inclusive. Michelle is currently an SVP and business line owner at Bill. Before that, she led sales for the Americas at Hubs, overseeing a team of almost 800 people in the US, Canada, and Latin America. Before HubSpot, Michelle led the high growth product lines at LogMeIn. Michelle, welcome, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Lucas. I'm excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about your background. How'd you get into sales? What enticed you about it and that transition into sales leadership?
Yeah, I would say the sales bug was in my family. So I grew up, my mother was in sales most of my early years for sure. And so I would hear her on the couch setting meetings. She basically was a BDR before they had the term BDR. She referred to it as telemarketer, but she would sell, she would set up meetings for other executives. And she always had this competitive bug. And I saw a working mom who, whenever she needed a job, could always go out and find something to sell. And so I grew up with that. And then on the other side, I had my father, who was an accountant for Massport Authority for the state of Massachusetts. So I had this seller on one side and this analytical thinker on the other. And so I grew up with that as my background. I was always selling things in high school. I sold prom dresses to my class so that I would get a free prom dress. I sold the class trip to everyone in my class so I get the free trip. And that just continued on through college. And then when I graduated, when I didn't know what I wanted to do, I said, maybe I'll try a job in sales, and moved to New York City. And that's how it started. I started in the sales departments at some of the largest media companies.
Is there anything in that background that you'd point to that you would say gave you the determination and drive to succeed in sales? Succeeding in sales, as we know, takes a lot of resilience. Where'd that resilience come from for you?
My parents were really into building confident children and telling us, if you get knocked down, you get back up. And I played very competitive sports growing up. I was in Junior Olympics. And so it was very much a failure isn't an endpoint. Failure is an iteration. And so I really used that as fuel. And I think when you can find a product that you really like, and for me, I actually really gravitated towards women's fashion magazines. I didn't even know that's something that I liked. And when I realized I could actually get a job at a women's fashion magazine in the sales department, it didn't feel like selling. It felt like really leaning into a product that I thought was really cool and I could get behind. And so I think it was that interest in the product paired with this resiliency and persistence that I learned from my parents that really helped.
You mentioned confidence in terms of what came from your parents, but a product that you can really believe in helps, I think, have confidence in that moment of sales as well.
Yeah, for sure. The first magazine I worked for was Harper's Bazaar magazine, where I was an intern. The next one was Vogue magazine, which at the time, this was pre-internet advertising. It was the biggest magazine in the world. And so to be able to be in the sales department at a place like that, it was pretty spectacular to learn from the women who worked there.
So you had success as a seller, and which can be very lucrative. And so some people decide to stay as successful sellers and continue to get better at it and sell bigger things, make more money over time, and other people decide to get into sales leadership, why did you take the leadership path instead of continuing on the success you had as a seller?
You know, I ask myself that question all the time, Lucas. Hey. No, I'm going to say there's a part of me that really envies the long-term individual contributor for the reasons that you said. It can be more flexible. It's certainly very lucrative, as is sales management as well. But when I was in high school, I was captain of my sports teams. When I was in Junior Olympics, I was captain of the team I was on for softball. I was always in kind of leadership roles throughout my life. I'm the oldest sibling. And so I feel like I naturally gravitated towards leadership. It was something that always came natural to me and that others noticed about me. And I also, as I mentioned, with my dad's background, I always had this kind of analytical bent. And so I really like to look at patterns and themes and understand market dynamics that went beyond just what I sold, but how do we uplift the business, the product as a whole? And so I've always had my eyes a bit more on the 360 view than just driving towards my individual number. And then I would say the last piece is I really like to develop people. The people, the coaching, that element I think is such a gift that some leaders really lean into, others overlook. They find that as a tertiary part of the job. And so that piece was always compelling to me.
Yeah. I've shared before that I think one of the things that has helped me succeed as a sales leader is that I had to struggle to get good at sales. And so that struggle helped me help others be better at sales. Are there things that you'd point to that happened to you as a seller that has made you a stronger sales leader?
I dealt with a lot of anxiety during my 20s, like job-related anxiety. I was never the number one seller. I was never the top. And I would say in a big way, it was also because I tended to be the youngest. I worked with people who had been selling for 20 years, 30 years, and I was really wet behind the ears. And so that naturally, I was just so much younger than some of the other sellers that I worked with. A trick that I had at a certain point in my late 20s, I went back and I counted every close that I had, every deadline. And so depending on the magazine, some closed every 2 weeks. Some closed once a month, some closed once a quarter. It just depended on which product I was working on. And I counted them. And at a certain point, I said, okay, I've had over 100 closes total, 100 different deadlines, and I've survived. And so I had this conversation with myself that was about, like, you've been through this. You have to stop with the monthly anxiety and realize, like, you win some, you lose some. How do you win more than others? And so I started to go into my stats, and that movie Moneyball that came out really resonated with me. And I really appreciated how, you know, the baseball team had turned their head on how they had traditionally done things. And I started to do that and look at patterns in data when it came to number of meetings held, number of meetings created, conversion rates, dials, and I started to impart some of this information on others. Once I could separate myself, the ego, from the work, and I looked at the work as just that, work, I started to let go of some of the self-awareness, self-consciousness, like anxiety that I was creating for myself. That was some of the stuff that I definitely had to struggle on the mental side of things. And then separately, I would also say I was afraid to ask for the big deal. I had some other sellers around me that their average deal sizes were significantly higher. Some of these contracts I were working on were multi-million dollar contract, and my average deal size were $500,000. And I had to get over that preconceived notion that what I think is a lot of money and a big deal isn't necessarily what that company thinks is a lot of money or a big deal. So I had to work through some of that mental piece as well.
I love that you shared that. I think that the kind of vulnerability about sharing the struggles that you've gone through is one of the things that makes a great leader, and appreciate you sharing that with our audience today. We talked earlier about what are your pillars of building an elite sales organization. And one of the things that you talked about is making sure that you have the right data infrastructure. Yeah. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I have what I think is the good fortune of having worked on large sales orgs, high velocity sales orgs who tend to focus on SMB mid-market business. And so by way of that, there's a high amount of volume. And I'm actually building this out at the company I'm at right now. I had a meeting on it earlier today. And what I want to take a look at is for any rep on my team, I want to benchmark them on how they're performing against other reps. And so if it is, how many dials do you average? How many meetings do you average? What is your conversion rate? What is your average deal size? How do you pace week one, week two, week three, week four of the month? I like to look at that not because I want to hold someone accountable because they're down in one place versus the other. I want to understand, what do the best reps do? What is that pattern recognition that's pretty consistent? How do I impart that information onto the others? And how do I uplift the entire sales organization as a part of that? That's really hard to do when you don't have accessible data at the ready. And what I tend to find is companies grow and mature. Either you have an outdated set of data or systems and you need to upgrade them. You might need to buy SaaS tools in order to fulfill information like this. But that data access, that data integrity, validity, and your tech stack to be able to extract that data and make sense of it is a really important part of analyzing the trends of not just your sellers, but how the SKUs that you sell. And a whole other host of variables that feed into the business. It's funny, I wasn't a math person in college, but that is what makes sense to me in understanding how to uplift a sales organization. Then you take that data and then you can go to the individual and say, hey, Lucas, your buddy Pat right next to you actually has fewer dials. They have fewer meetings. And guess what? He hits his number every single month. Do you want to know how he's working less, but having better yield than you are, and using that to uplift people and find a path to them for them to hit their number?
Yeah. With the tools that are available today, we have access to I'm sure more data than ever before. A lot of times I'll listen to podcasts or read things on LinkedIn. People will be talking about key numbers that they follow, and it just seems to add to a never-ending list of, oh yeah, that sounds like a good one too. And that sounds like a good one too. And it's easy to go down a rabbit hole where there's all these numbers and it's easy to lose sight of what the important ones are for my organization. How do you make sure that when you're implementing, when you're thinking about data infrastructure, that you're able to focus on the important data?
That's a good question. It's one of the best things about sales is it's a combination of art and science. And yeah. So to your point, asking better discovery questions, going deeper on discovery, second, third layer question, reversing answers, mirroring your client, a lot of that is opaque and you need the quality control of a manager to get under the hood and read that part of the art. And so first you need your sales managers and your directors, your entire sales organization speaking the same language on methodology, expectations, and what good looks like in order to assess the art. Is that quality control healthy within the organization? So that's one piece of it. And then you constantly have to be highlighting, who is doing that well? Who is learning reversing? Who is walking away from a sale because they've been able to extract the right level of pain and say, maybe this isn't the right time, and show those examples. When you can infuse that quality and what that looks like, what it sounds like throughout the organization, that's the art piece. On the science piece, my recommendation is to hire someone smarter than me who is a sales productivity analyst. And the way I've seen this in some of the organizations that I've been in is analyzing everything from do a plot graph of reps who achieve on consistently over a 6-month period, over 100% attainment. Where are they on activity? Where are they on ops created? Where are they on meetings held? Where are they on kinds of meetings that were held, right? Do you have a balance of number of closing meetings per week, number of demos per week, number of discovery, how many ops are they creating in general? And so being able to have a really thorough analysis that is proactive, dynamic, and consistent, that again shows these are the right behaviors. In my experience, the variables that have been pretty consistent as the likelihood of deals to close is number of ops created and deal size. The best reps know how to find the right kinds of deals, and they know how to extract the right amount of value from those deals. Depending on the sales organization, again, if you're highly transactional, if your one call closes, that's where activity can go higher on that list of variables. But I would say deal size and that consistency of ops created is a big one. And then the other one is pipeline coverage. How much pipeline coverage do you have, and how does that benchmark against the team as a whole and your own personal win rate? And so making sure that you're consistently having that pipeline coverage in the balance of what's in that pipeline.
The number of ops created, curious about that one, because I like sometimes I hear, oh, yeah, your best reps are the ones that are out there always finding new ways to create reps. They do some of their own prospecting, create their own opportunities. And also, you'll also hear from sometimes the same people, sometimes other people. The best reps are the ones who are disqualifying deals the earliest and not getting opportunities out of them. I would expect to see fewer ops created out of those reps. And so can you tell us a little bit more about what you look for in terms of ops created?
Yeah. So I would say it's ops created and deal size, not ops created or deal size. And so it really is the balance of those two. And I wouldn't say that ops created is the highest volume. It is that right volume consistently that pairs with the win rate and the deal size. And I know that feels a little kludgy and it doesn't sound as though there's a silver bullet in there. It really is that combination. And I would also say the consistency. It's a rolling 3 to 6 month average and looking at, is there a deviation, a standard deviation beyond a rep's behaviors in any of those facets, deal size, everyone will have a huge deal every now and then, and that throws everything off. But if you take the median and you're also looking at the consistency of ops created paired with conversion, those are the three levers you really have to look at pretty consistently. And when you take a look at the best rep consistently compared to the others, and typically I would say it's probably the top two or three, because depending on the month, there's a different person leading again, because you have an outlier deal. But you want to take a look at what are those similar behaviors that are happening with the top group consistently, and how do you help others mirror that? An example that we talked about before is the art. Is there someone who's disqualifying? Really, what does that look like? Are they taking out certain industries? Are they not calling generic email contacts that are coming into the funnel? Are they making sure that they're only going after businesses that have a business email address? What are some of those elements to make sure that they're bringing quality ops, and that translates to your overall win rate?
You mentioned before, talking about the art, who's doing the key parts, as you just brought back up with an example. When you find a rep who's, okay, this is, they're disqualifying well, or they're making sure that they always book the next meeting at the end of every other meeting, or they're doing great on disc- when you find someone who's doing like a key part, what do you do with that to elevate that and teach those skills to the rest of the organization?
My recommendation to any team would be managers should be all over it and sharing that in team meetings pretty consistently. And so you have your weekly team meeting, you close the books on a month, you have your number one rep, you take a look at what have they done well, you take a gong snippet or chorus or HubSpot, whoever it is that's recording the calls, and you share that out with the team and you have everyone dissect it based on the sales methodology. What did you hear in this call? What did Sally do? Did she talk to me about her discovery? And so there's all sorts of elements like that. Discovery could be that multi-layer questioning. For a demo, it can be having them do a reverse demo. So you actually ask the prospect, can you demo the tool for me? I want you to understand the ease of use and how this would work in your environment and with your use case. So you want to elevate the kind of behaviors that you have shared out to the organization. And do that, whether it is in a quarterly call, creating a program that you do a spiff for anyone who uses a negative reverse this month, whoever does the best negative reverse. So there's all sorts of programmatic ways that you can recommend that reps start to work on more of a qualitative skill. That can go as far as this rep cross-sells really well. This rep knows how to push for more users on the account and not a rolling rollout. So there are so many different elements, but again, this is the part where data can be dangerous, because some organizations get so data focused, they forget about the qualitative and it ends up being a disservice to their customers in the end. And so that qualitative conversation and that art of selling, which I like to call the art of the conversation, that's really the element that sales organizations can't forget about. That's where the goods are.
So can you give us an example of that? Like what would, if an organization's taken data too far or potentially taken data too far and taken some of the art out, what are some of the signs of that?
I'll give you an example. When we were at HubSpot, we had years and years ago, we had certain reps that were selling our enterprise SKU really well. And we had some reps that weren't selling it. And if you didn't have at least two deals on enterprise per month, you weren't going to hit your number. And if you weren't hitting your number, you're probably at 75, 80%. If you're below 80%, you are at risk of being on a performance plan. Mm-hmm. And so if you're really struggling with selling enterprise, a manager can say to that rep, you're not selling enterprise. If you don't sell enterprise, you're not going to hit your number. And the rep clearly doesn't know how to and might be too insecure to say to their manager, it's not working for me.
Yeah.
What the manager then has to do is go and listen to the calls and hear, was there an opportunity here? Like, number one, are they qualifying the right kinds of customers? Are they large enough to get into that SKU? If they do have that customer, are they going deep enough in the questions when they're in discovery? What are the feature sets in enterprise that they should hear, listen, understand whether or not this would be a good fit? Then how do they position it? And so there was a rep we had, I remember, who it was really her positioning, and she didn't know how to put out the big number, the annual contract value for enterprise, because she was afraid to say it. And so she would give them a monthly number. Then by the time you actually put the whole package together, it was a bit of sticker shock. And then she backed off right away. So her problem was not just the positioning and uncovering that there was an opportunity. It was the packaging of the pricing that she fell short on. So we got under the hood. We understood what the why was, why she wasn't selling that kind of SKU. And then we gave her examples of how other reps position it. Then we had her manager give her a two-week sprint that she had to send him examples of how she used it on the gong call. And he could score her and say, you did a really good job here. You got out of your comfort zone. You didn't get out of your comfort zone. And they could work together on that skill. But that was an example of how assessed, prescribed, and really dissected what the problem was and worked on a solution to help up-level and upskill the rep.
So the data told you that there was a rep who wasn't hitting quota. And if you're jumping to conclusions on the data, then you might jump to the conclusion that the rep isn't capable. But when you go and explored the why, you realize this rep just needed to be equipped with additional tools, and she was very capable. One of the factors of if you're just looking at the data is you only get the what, and a lot of times you don't get the why, and you really need to do that hard work to go figure out the why.
I think some organizations don't create a coaching culture. It's a bit more sink or swim.
Yeah.
And if you haven't figured it out on your own, then we're going to put you on a PIP if you can't hit your number. And the manager might also say, you're not selling enough enterprise. That's why you're not hitting your number. It's the what, but they don't get to the how. And organization, your people are an asset. And I tell managers that your team is an asset that you are managing for the company. And so you have to measure managers on what percent of your team churns out due to poor performance. What percent of your team is over 100%? What percent of your team is between 90 and 100? What percent is between 80 and 90? And so the health of a manager is measured by the distribution of rep performance on that team. And so if you have a manager who has a distribution of a lot of reps who are churning out and they're just backfilling them, that's actually an organizational problem. That's not just a manager problem. And so it's that those health metrics for your frontline managers that you got to be looking at as well to make sure that you have a healthy organization and you're making the most of the people assets that you bring on board and that are interfacing with your customers.
You brought up coaching culture. Can you tell us a little bit about what that means to you?
Yes. Yeah. I think I gave you a couple of examples there. But again, you have to assume like your people are your assets and it's up to you to get the highest return on the investment of your assets. And the highest return, are they happy? Are they culturally additive? Are they bringing energy to the organization? Are they hitting their number? Are they beating their number? And are they setting the pace to bring the bar to a new level? So that's like foundationally the kind of environment that you want to set. And so I just came on board with Bill about 7 months ago. And when I had my first meeting with managers in-house, I laid out some of these expectations. Like the expectation is we are 100% and above organization. The expectation is a manager is there to coach up their team. Like their team is the company asset. It's on you to make them successful. And I think in general in sales, there's a lot of blame game, right? I didn't get this deal. I didn't hit my number because marketing didn't give me enough leads. I didn't hit my number because none of the leads were good enough. I didn't hit my number because of the macroeconomic environment. I didn't hit my number because I have reps on my team that shouldn't have been hired in the first place. And so if they shouldn't have been hired in the first place, it's the manager's fault for hiring them, number one. If we did hire them, what did you do? What were the manager's actions to make them successful? And so my directors who oversee managers, I'm asking them, what are you doing to make that manager successful? And then I'm asking them, what is the manager doing to make the rep successful? And what does that look like in written form, both qualitatively and from a stats perspective? And it has to really be a living, breathing ethos within an org. And the director is there to upskill managers. The manager is there to upskill rep. Really, you have to create that culture of expectation.
I've heard some people say that they think like the processes that you've set up and the coaching culture, one of the signs of that is how big your middle tier of reps is and whether their performance is improving over time. You have a top tier who is probably like they've gotten to a point where hopefully they're getting better, but they're not relying on the coaching to succeed. You might have a bottom tier who might not be in the right job or might have outside circumstances that are keeping them from performing in the job right now. But most of the people are that bottom tier can be really big or it can be pretty small with the big tier being really big. And so how big that middle tier is and like whether the middle tier's performance is improving over time, I've heard is like a good sign for whether you have the right processes in place. Do you agree with that or how do you think of that?
I totally agree with that. Yep. 100%. If you know, a sales plan, an organizational sales plan, when you take a look at a rep by rep basis, it has to be well balanced. It's like a bell curve. And you'll have fewer people that are 100%, 110% and above. You'll have ideally fewer people that are below 80%. And you want that 80 to 100% to be the bulk of the organization. Most sales organization plans are built that way to assume 80% attainment, some 90% attainment, but totally agree. It's that middle group you want to strengthen.
In your history as a salesperson and a sales leader, is there something that you've seen that has really made you point to like coaching is really important?
I would say most of the organizations I've been at, almost all, had a talent funnel that started with BDRs. And so you want if a BDR is moving into an SMB role, you want your SMB reps moving into a mid-market role. You want your mid-market reps moving into a corporate enterprise role. And you want to create a career trajectory. The longer reps are on board, the more productive that they are. So if you can retain your people, they're happy. You have that institutional knowledge. They also offer mentoring to and help uplift the people that are coming up the ranks as well. And so you really create this really nice engine for talent. And so it is in an organization's best interest, in my belief, to have a really robust coaching culture purely for the retention purposes. And selfishly, I like to develop people. I think that's one of the biggest benefits of a role of a leader is to be able to develop people who they work with. There's a selfish component for me as well, but I will say not every organization agrees with that. I've met with other sales organizations where CEOs have said, we assume we're going to churn out 40% of our sales org. It's sink or swim, and that's our model. And it's really a different philosophy in how you get to the end game.
When you're looking for maybe at the top of that funnel, when you're hiring rep, you're going to coach them, but how do you make sure that you're hiring the people that are going to be coachable?
Yeah, love that. So we actually, at HubSpot, we did a study. We had an intern from MIT Business School program who came and analyzed all of our hires 12 months, 24 months after we had hired them. And they looked at a scorecard of attributes that we had. Attributes were like a commitment to winning, intellectual curiosity, resilience, empathy. I'm forgetting the last one, but coachability. That was the other one. And the number one indicator from an attribute to success was actually coachability. The other one was also intellectual curiosity. And in speaking of coaching, I think the balance isn't just frontline managers are responsible to upskill their people. It's also you need people on board who are willing to take coaching. They are willing to fail and get better. They're intellectually curious. So that ideally, and this is something that I did throughout my entire career, they are actively seeking how they can be better, whether it's reading sales books, listening to podcasts, it's asking some of the veterans on the team. So it really is, you need to get the right mindset on board. And that's what I've seen in terms of hiring the right kinds of people that help fuel growth within an organization.
I love that. When you think about the things that we've talked about today, two or three takeaways that you have for our audience?
I would definitely say The role of a frontline manager cannot be underestimated. It is integral to an organization in two parts. One, I would definitely say the hiring, making sure you're bringing the right people on board who are intellectually curious, who want to win, but they're also coachable. And the other part is that the frontline manager is responsible for the ROI of like your people asset. And so they got to coach people up, and that is both qualitatively, but using the quant, the data, to help inform where they can focus their time as a manager and getting under the hood and listening to the conversations, understanding how they're positioning, packaging, pricing, all the elements of the goodness that happens in the sales cycle. It's not just art. It's not just science. It really is a combination of two, and understanding which levers are the right ones to pull.
That's good. I love that. I also love how you shared with us your early career struggles with anxiety and how you turned that into, and there's a lot of people out there listening who might feel some of that right now. And you put this something together that helped you get over that. And you've gone on to have just tremendous success that all of us can admire. So I really appreciate you sharing that with us. If you enjoyed this episode of Building Elite Sales Teams, please leave us a review in your podcast app. You can find more of our content online at yardstick.team/blog. And if you have any feedback from us, you connect with me on LinkedIn. Thanks for joining us today. Thanks for joining us today on Building Elite Sales Teams. Please remember to give us a 5-star review. And if you want more information about Yardstick, you can find us at www.yardstick.team. You can follow me or connect with me on LinkedIn by searching for Lucas Price.